Hey guys, this is Beau DeMeo, and you're listening to the M6P.
Well, welcome to the M6P special edition. We are joined today by Beau DeMeo. Great last name, by the way, man. Great
I
last
know,
name.
share that. We share that.
Love it. I told the guys I'm going to leave them and you and I are going to have a podcast, Mayo DeMeo or something like that. It'd be great.
Or it could be like Hold the Mayos.
Oh, I like it. I like it. So we're going to be talking to Beau today a little bit about this show called X-Men 97. We've got a ton of questions. He's got a ton of answers. I'm sure he'll keep some things to himself too. But we're going to try and get everything out of him that we can. All right? So,
Awesome.
Beau, let's start off with the roster. So we have the roster from the original series, but then Bishop was also added. We had some Sunspot thrown in there, and we had new hairstyles for Storm, Bishop, and Morph got a new face. So can you kind of tell me about bringing the new stuff in and how that happened?
Well, Morph is probably the biggest one to tackle, right? Because they had the biggest shift from what you saw in the original series. Morph was, when I initially pitched it to Marvel, Morph was not part of the roster, actually. And then Brad Winterbaum, the head of streaming, was like, "We got to put Morph in there. Like, his death was so iconic." I was like, "Yeah, you're right. He is." But it seemed like he kind of buried his drama in with the Sentinels. But let's find a way to bring him back. But it just, the original roster is amazing in that show. I think we would all agree. But I think what's changed when you look at like the Krakoa arcs, as even Grant Morrison's arc, is the freak factor, for lack of a better term, became a little bit more popular after 2000. And so the major kind of motivation was just to add a little bit more mutantum, because Beast is really the only character in that original lineup that aesthetically looks like a mutant. Cyclops' visor's cool looking. Wolverine's got the weird hair, but you don't have anybody who's like, "Wow, that's a mutant." And so it actually allowed us to kind of beat back against the Morlocks' biggest complaint against the X-Men, which is like, it's the pretty people club. It allowed us to bring a little bit more diversity. I don't mean diversity in the way that we think about it, in the way that mutants would view it, into the team. So that was the motivation there. And the changeling form is just so freaking cool. And it allowed us to kind of harken back to the character's origins and what the Lee Wants wanted to do with that character, and where they were drawing from with Mimic and Changeling with that character. Storm, oh my God, the amount of crap I got for 2 years after we showed that Mohawk. And I was like, it was the biggest clue to what story arc we were going to do. I think anybody who follows me on social media, outside of my love of taking off my shirt, knows that I absolutely love canon, and I will try to stick to canon as much as possible. And I knew we were going to do Life Death. And that Mohawk is just so iconic during that arc. The cover of her and Forge, which we kept the Daisy Dukes that Forge has on that, that cover art, is just so iconic to me. So I kind of fast forwarded a little bit. I was like, you know what? That's a great little hide and seek to play with fans. And we'll see how many people put together, like, okay, if they're doing the Mohawk, there are some pretty major moments in the comic books that when she has that Mohawk. And it's when she loses her powers, when she fights Cyclops without her powers, and when she falls in love with Forge. And so, like, although we got a lot of crap for it, I remember pitching it when I was just watching fans. I was like, when you guys see the show, it's going to make so much more sense. And I knew I wanted the Beyonce glow up moment in episode 6, when we were going to take her back to just giant size X-Men and just the classic. It's such a beautiful costume. Both costumes are beautiful, but there is something that's just so Foxy Brown, so Queen of Africa about that giant size X-Men look. You wouldn't have gotten, and I knew I wanted to harken back to the moment in the shopping mall. I still remember as a kid watching that moment when, like, she's shopping, and then you start asking questions like, "Storm, why do you shop for clothes? Just use lightning to make your clothes be anything. But it's such an iconic moment in the original show, and so it was a cool way to start planting those seeds. And I think you guys also know that's the darkest Storm skin color. We had Chase Conley and I really took that cause on. That's the darkest Storm has ever appeared in any comic or media ever. We really,
Wow.
you know, it was a different era too in the 90s, obviously, but if you look at like Storm sometimes in the original series next to like Rogue, they're like two shades off. And then when we had done Roberto, we were doing character lineups. When we had done Roberto, which, you know, there's a lot of controversy around the decision of Roberto, but, you know, Marvel wanted to make him Latino. And then when we had Storm and Roberto in the character lineup, Chase Conley and I, Chase Conley is one of the directors, we're just like, yeah, she's the same shade as Roberto. Let's just go ahead and push her skin color and really capture where she's from. And then Bishop. Bishop was an interesting one because I'm not going to knock the curls, but they're definitely a choice of their era. And because I knew at least in season one he was going to be on screen for just a little bit, I didn't want to have to kind of like do the gymnastics of making the audience understand why he kind of has the Rico Suave haircut from the 90s. You know, so I went through basically all the comic book runs. Actually, when I started on the show, I put together like God, it must have been a 40 something page visual lookbook of all the characters' looks through the comics and the different costumes I wanted to take them through and hairstyles. Like, I'm a freaking gay man. I spend 20 hours on character creation when I'm playing a video game. Like, this is where I was going to spend a lot of my time. And so it's where we had a lot of these discussions of like, how can we use costume and hair to tell these character stories? And for some reason, Bishop's kind of short crop top look felt right to me. His bald look and his like crew cut look from like the Onslaught era, and especially from Saya Complex Forward, it's too much of a militant look. That's kind of his bad boy stage where he, especially in the later comics, he became a bad guy. He's trying to kill Hope. So that felt like a good middle ground to take, kind of keep him at. So that's where that came from. And it just felt like, you know, he landed in the 90s in my mind after Beyond Good and Evil. And he's probably looking around and being like, you know, people like Rogue and Storm have these haircuts. I don't. So I should probably change my hair up, was kind of my thinking there.
Well, I
I love it.
my son is African American, and sitting there watching with him and seeing Bishop's hair, you know, it may seem like a small thing, but it's really a cool thing when he's trying to kind of define his look, and he's, you know, he's in a family of white people, and so he's looking around and he's saying, you know, like, what do I want to look like? Who can I? Who is cool out there? Who is a cool role model that kind of I can look like? And when I saw the that kind of that hair, and I look at him and I'm like, man, we could do this. Now his sisters want him to do the Killmonger hair, and but his mom is not about
Yeah, he's got to get a little bit more rage. No kidding. Like, it's funny, I've been
that.
raised by white people as well. And, like, that's, I think I've talked about this in a couple interviews. A lot of the show's about, and you can talk to your son about this, about being a black man, you know, raised by, you know, white parents. And, like, you just said, like, when you're defining who you are and your parents don't necessarily reflect that, it's a very different journey. And so even for me, and like I talk a lot about this with some of my friends, like my friends, not in a bad way. They're like, you know, you came into yourself on X-Men in a lot of ways, because as I was writing it and exploring some of these issues of identity and self-acceptance, I found myself reflecting on my childhood and my growth and being like, am I my most authentic self? Like, Storm's entire storyline is about kind of my struggle to accept my blackness and my black power and all of that, and how we're taught. I don't care who you are, white, black, gay, straight. You're kind of taught sometimes to humble your talents, and the humble thing that makes you different because you want to fit in. I mean, this is the essence of X-Men, right? Conformity versus standing out, and the virtue of standing out. And so I found myself having to channel a lot of that into the show because I was also going through it in real life.
I wanted to ask you, like, with, you know, there's so much going on, and yet there's still this time in every episode for these wonderful monologues. And the writing is just fantastic. I love some of these quotes. I just want to read you some of these quotes that you wrote, so you know them. But man, when Magneto says, "Don't make me let you down," like it's such a threat But at the same time, he's saying, look, this is up to you. These are your choices, and how you respond to us is going to dictate how this goes. And when Val Cooper says, man, I was afraid, but I wasn't surprised. Nobody was surprised. Those are just some iconic lines. So, like, how did you shape that monologue and make it work with the stories that you wanted to tell? Because it is a pretty fast-paced season. You kind of said, okay, I mean, this is my guess, and I want your take on this. Did you say, okay, I want to do this storyline, this storyline, this storyline, this storyline, and I want to see how I can make, like, how did you choose which ones to do, I guess?
One, thank you. That means a lot. And hats off to my graduate school playwriting professor, because I people compliment my dialogue. I'm like, I had Dan Dietz, who actually went on to become a writer on Westworld, and then Mark Wheatley, who's a very, very, very renowned playwright in London that I got to study with. And I always tell people the way I wrote before I took 2 semesters of playwriting and after, it was night and day. It was
Wow.
night and day. You know, so when I first when they first approached me, I knew they wanted to reboot the series or revive it. And even when they pitched it, it was like, is this a spiritual successor? Is this a sequel? Is it something Tyler to do? I was like, let's just make it a spiritual successor, but I knew it was just going to be a successor, and it was going to be warming them up to that idea. And I think Brad Winterbaum too knew that too, but we just had to kind of warm people up. It's very scary for a studio to say, hey, we're going to make what is this technically season 6 of a show that has not been on for about 25, I'm getting my math, what's time? You know, years anyways. It's a really nerve-wracking idea, especially when it's animated, because you're thinking about a generation that may not have been born, even though slowly Hollywood is realizing the demographic for animated TV is now just everyone almost at this point. And so, I mean, I'll be honest, I wish I had this grand answer of like, I was selfish. I'm a fan. I was like, what's the thing that I like from that era? I was like, I know I want to do Uncanny X-Men 25. I know I'm gonna rip Wolverine's, you know, and we're gonna do the mind wipe. I know I want to do what you call it. I knew I wanted to do Inferno. It's one of the biggest untouched arcs. Didn't know if I could do it in an episode, but we were able to do it in an episode. And then so like that's where I kind of started. Like, what are the things I really want to do? And then I have always had a soft spot for Bastion. You know, he's like one of those characters that gets often overlooked. And that was I think also maybe yours, Jared. Like, that's my, like, I was in high school and I was like able to read comic books and they held my comic books at the comic book. I had my slot. That was when Operation Zero Tolerance. So it was just like such a fond, when you're talking about making a show that's going to tap nostalgia, but elevate it, it just went directly to my heart. And so I knew I wanted to do that. And then once I started there, I was like, okay, what do I actually want to talk about? And because actually, like, I came to writing as a career after I came to history. I studied history. So I kind of just went back to what I find fascinating about history and the cycle of history and the cycle of oppression and repression that we go through. And Magneto's monologue in episode 2 is all about that, when he talks about the, you know, we sing this song to one another, the oppressed become the oppressors. And then I wanted to, you know, we're in the middle of 2020, which I think, you know, we're all still recovering. And I always kind of talk to people about, I just remember as a kid, 9/11. And I also remember Pulse, which was the nightclub in Orlando that got shot up, a gay club. And I was there 2 weeks before it happened. I had friends there when it happened. And I just remember seeing Orlando kind of fracture over that. And then it made me think back to 9/11 again, where like the world, all of us actually, I think we're all in the same generation. We grew up in like the history books of like, but we got the Atlantic Ocean and we got the Pacific Ocean and Canada, like we're safe. And I just remember 9/11, all of us just going that illusion of safety that we all grew up with in the 80s and 90s of like the bad happens over there. It shattered us. And so then I was just like, what we gotta do, I'm gonna see if they'll let me do this. I wanna do E's for Extinction. And that's when I started to come up with what I wanted to do thematically with the audience, which is kind of take audiences on the journey that I think if you watch the original series, you had experienced. Take the X-Men on the same one, where in the, you know, in the 90s and 80s, we felt safe. There's racism, but it's like, oh, we're getting better. We're getting better. Things are getting good, getting good. And then 9/11 happened. And then you just see I don't care where your politics and why, but like that's where our country just became really divided. And then you had Occupy Wall Street, then you had COVID and all these things. And so that the story of the X-Men became a story about us, which is a future you don't see coming. And that suddenly you are forced to kind of evolve into a future that you weren't ready for. But the irony is that the X-Men are supposed to be that evolution, and now they're faced with a future that even Xavier could not have seen coming, which is Bastion. What made Bastion so fascinating is if you look at his backstory, I tweaked it, but essentially he is a human born Sentinel. And that's why it was so important for him to say, like, I was born this way. It turns the entire ideology of the X-Men on its head. Because here is a creature who was born to hate them and can't help it. And so it started to get to some of the messiness that I think we all feel nowadays when we're talking about, wokeism and Me Too and Occupy Wall Street and Black rights and gay rights. The conversations are so much more complicated than what they were 30 years ago. And there's no easy answers outside of where, I think the season, I hope most people took away from it, which is that empathy is going to be our best way forward. And that's what Cyclops said. The empathy is going to be our best way forward because everyone is so traumatized. Everyone has all this baggage. Everyone is different that we need to start using empathy to try to repair these bridges. And even in Xavier's dream, it's what he says, it's messy. Coexistence is messy. It's not a clean experience. So that's kind of how the entire season kind of revealed itself to me and how to tie it all together. And like I will tell you that speech in episode 8 was directly influenced by, I remember at the top of 2021 when the world started to open up again. And then suddenly Black Lives Matter petered out. And then you watch the same happen with Me Too and these cycles. And I wrote that monologue actually before I even wrote the first script, that I knew I wanted a character to talk about this deja vu of we watch these tragedies, and these tragedies are so big. That is what Bastion says in episode 8. They're almost too big to compute. Gaza, Ukraine, it's almost too big for us to compute. And so it's exactly what Val says. Like, we have a sense of deja vu, and then we get on with our day. And so we always end up in the same ugly place. And so I knew we were always driving. And when I met with Catherine Disher, who played the original Jean Grey, I was like, I'm having you do Val because I need someone who I just need that gravitas that you had at Jean to deliver what is possibly going to be the most important monologue in season one that ends with, obviously the line I knew I wanted to get in there, which was Magneto is right. So that's where all that came from. Then, his speech in episode 2, it's like I had to find a way to do Xavier's dream, but Magneto's version of it. And so it's like he's saying, like, hey, look, I'm willing to work with you guys here, but like you said, it is ultimately your choice. Please. And then you just see them let him down. And it sets up his villain arc for the rest of the season.
So if I got a question regarding Bastion, actually, and when he appears and we get the unveil and Bright Eyes and everything. So like that whole scene where he's got Magneto tied up and everything, I'm a big movie fan. That reminded me of Reservoir Dogs from the whole everything there to the music. I don't know if it was intentional or anything. It just felt like,
That and Marathon Man.
oh wow, cool.
That and
I did not
absolutely.
know Marathon Man. That's fun.
Yep. Good. You're the first person who's ever caught that, actually. But yeah, that was definitely an influence for that. But no, with Bastion, like I did some rebranding on Bastion because I love him in the comics, but to make him like really, I wanted him to have. I think I was talking to Meredith Lane, our casting director, who I'd worked on Witcher Nightmare Wolf with. And I was like, we need somebody who can make genocide sound sexy. And we had worked with Theo James as Vesemir on Witcher Nightmare of the Wolf. She's like, how about Theo without the accent? And so we met with him. I was like, you are basically Don Draper. And then we pushed it even further. And why, we picked that barber scene is this is a man who has no boundaries. And to see someone like Magneto, who is all about my presence, I am a king, and here's a man taking the smallest piece of metal to the master of magnetism's face, and he can do nothing, is just the ultimate form of humiliation for someone like that. That he has the balls to do that and just tells him, like, just be still, you were born for this, is just like you wanted something that was just like, this guy is a violator.
my kids were asking me what was going on in that scene, and like, is he being nice? Is he being mean? I was like, well, he's shaving him, but I had to explain to them like, this is showing dominance and showing you have nothing here, and what you thought you had, I'm gonna bring down low so that you it. It's a mind control manipulation. It's tough to explain
Very
to
tough.
people.
It is. And I was very aware of that. A lot of the arguments I had with Marvel in season two, which led to creative differences, which led to all the drama, was like, is this a show for kids or is this a show for adults? And I'm a big believer that the original series, why we all loved it, is it felt like with Batman the animated series, you were watching something we shouldn't be watching. And there are moments where you're like, whoa, this is going over my head. And I'm going to rewatch this until I'm of the age where I understand what they're talking about. So I definitely, and we have, in my personal, humble opinion, I think we have, like, we coddle our kids too much sometimes. At least from a studio standpoint, I hear these notes. I'm just like, guys, like, trust parents, like, to guide their kids through these topics. It's actually, very helpful sometimes. As I had another, my best friend, for showrunner, actually, reached out. He was watching it with his kids, and he was like, thank you. He's like, you kind of gave us a tool to start talking about some stuff that we didn't know how to talk about with our kids. But it is, he treats them like pets, and that's how Bastion sees mutants. They're pets. If you even look at the next episode, it's a very subtle detail. We pushed it through. It was worse. In episode eight, if you look, when we introduce Magneto strung up, Bastion actually has him on a leash and then hands the leash to Daria. Before he goes back, he treats them like animals.
But the four of us are all the same age. So we are tracking with you on everything. Like with Bastion, that was like high school, late junior high, you know? And then we all went to college during E is for Extinction and had kids during Utopia. And so the four of us, like we are tracking with you. When you say Bastion and Operation Zero Tolerance, we're like, yes, I was in 10th grade. Like I remember that, you know? Totally,
I'm so
totally.
surprised that people didn't see it coming because it's like, one, I think you guys have seen he's in every episode in some shape, way, shape, or form. But like when Garrick says like tolerance is extinction, I'm like, gosh, they're gonna figure this out fast. And I was like, oh, they did it. Okay. It wasn't until I think episode six I saw a few people guessing if it was gonna be Bastion. But it was interesting because something I am a big believer is playing fair with the audience. And not cheating. If you rewatch the series, like everything is there from go. From the very first thing when in Friends of the Humanity, when Berto's getting captured, he's like, yeah, some guy's paying us 10,000 grand to use him as target practice. Talking about Bastion, like it's there. We play very fair, even with Jean's vision. I was so scared about that vision. That was a vision I wrote. I was like, this is gonna be so cool. And I'm like, is it too on the nose? Are people gonna figure this out? But I was like, you know what? I'd rather them feel like we played fair. Like you hear Ace of Base, it's slowed down, but you hear the choir from Happy Nation in that vision with her. And that was something I was really proud of the team. And we never cheated for a twist. It was all in front of you. And I hope it makes the rewatchability of it that much more satisfying.
Oh yeah, it was definitely rewatching. Let's talk about an iconic moment from the first episode. I mean, there was an iconic moment every 3 minutes, but when Gambit jumps on Wolverine and charges him up, what happened? Everybody cannot come to a consensus. Did
I will
Wolverine
tell
blow up or what?
yes. So this is actually a big piece of debate between me and Jay Castorina, the supervising director, because that beat was in his pitch. He had done like a little mini animatic when he was being interviewed for the job that was just showing the X-Men doing their powers. And then in episode one, we got to this beat where we were running out of time and we had this awesome action sequence, but we didn't have enough time to do the scripted version of how they defeat Master Mold. And I was like, what if we just use that beat that you already boarded and lay it in there. But what was funny, the entire season we would talk about what he did. And from the day we met, we were always like, he was like, I think this would happen. I'm like, no, I think he probably explodes, dude. And like, has to. So, like, that was actually a nerdy fan thing that none of us on the crew would ever agree on. My personal interpretation is that his arms blew off, the adamantium is not destroyed. It would have rechanneled it, it would have reverberated, or I guess what, kind of
Regenerate.
backtouched it back through his flesh. And so that's why when you see him in the beat after that, when the X-Men are all hanging out, his clothes are all tattered and he's a little burned up. So that was, but like, trust me, lots of debates. both on
Okay.
the crew up into the, I mean, if you sat down with the crew, if I took five random crew members right now and said, what happened? You would get different interpretations. And I kind of like that because I miss those just pure nerdy science debates about characters' powers. Versus like some of the more intense debates that happen nowadays with fandom, I'm like, I don't know if we should be like, that may be a therapy discussion, you know? Like, we had a big day in episode two where it was like, how does Magneto breathe in space, and how does this bubble actually work? And I'm like, guys, we can talk about
Okay.
this all day, but you know what? It's cool, and that's what it ultimately came down to. We saw it; it's a cool moment. Let's do it.
So yeah, I'd like a follow-up question about that. So, obviously the some fans are going to nitpick and everything, and it's not going to make sense and everything. I loved how you wrote in the reference to Kamar-Taj and with respect to like some points in history, no matter what, can't be changed. And it was clear that you were like, okay, not only is this a cool story beat, but also it's one of those things like, all right, it kind of diffuses the whole thing. Well, how come Cable didn't come back and change it? And I love later on where it's like, how many times did you try to beat me and you failed? 200 times. So how did you decide which of those arguments to tackle and which ones to say, well, we're just going to let this go because it's an awesome thing?
Yeah, ultimately, like, if you look at this, if the season as a whole, there's a couple themes, and some of them were like very much intentional. Some of them I kind of brought out when I was crafting the season and working the scripts with writers and directors. But one of them is about the kind of the unavoidable nature of trauma. And so, to me, part of what we're talking about and what the X-Men are so powerful about is they're essentially a healing community, right? They welcome people in who just have deep trauma. And to me, if you can just go back in the past and erase your trauma, you actually regress as a human being. Because although trauma can be very heartbreaking, it actually does spur character growth. I mean, if you watch a good movie, a lot of people say, like, I hate drama in real life. And then we all love movies. Why do you love movies? Because the second act is all about drama and someone becoming a better version of themselves. And so that's what it really came down to, was just saying there are some things in our lives that must exist, even though they're painful. For Magneto, there's many. And his whole arc is literally the moment where he finally sits with Xavier, and Xavier is having to teach him to remember who he is, but in order to do that, he has to make him remember the Holocaust. And to see Magneto at once remember it, confront it, but lean on his best friend to help him rise above it is essentially what we're talking about with that trauma. I mean, Xavier says it when he says, like, you know, it draws you to others and they will swim and keep you afloat when your limbs tire, and vice versa. That's where I just made the decision of, like, there has to be some things where we just can't go back in the past and change it. And then also, just as a storyteller, you know, it's my issue with multiverse storytelling is the stakes, there has to be stakes. There has to be this sense that someone, when dead, is dead. And that doesn't mean they have to stay dead. Obviously, there's a very big clue at the end of season one that someone's coming back. But the clue is that is going to come at a cost. And that is going to be a challenge for the team. I think that's why the Phoenix Saga works so well. Although it's about resurrection, Jean suffers. The team suffers each time she dies and comes back. It's heavy on the team. It weighs heavy on them. So when I was talking about it, like, I talked about it as chronal points, and then Brad Winterbaum and I were talking. He's like, we could use the absolute points if we want to have like a loose tie, because that's a lexicon that people already have in their head. I was like, oh, that's cool. And like, they give a couple nods to the MCU, even though they're not directly connected, could be cool. But that's really where that came from, is I just needed some sort of a canon reason to make sure episode five couldn't just be unwritten, you
Yeah.
know? And it needed to not just be contrived, but I think why you don't feel it's contrived is thematically and emotionally, we pay it off.
I think be, even though it's a fast-paced thing, throughout the entire first season, I felt like the stakes were really there and the stakes were really high. And even though I've watched the animated series from 92 and I see people come back and I see, like you know all this. And yet I'm watching this and I'm, man, man, this is, they're in a dire situation and it is affecting everybody. I felt that every single episode. I
That's
thought it was
awesome.
great.
All right, Bo, I have a question. Get a little bit more lighthearted back to just, I think was one of the most across the internet, coolest scenes. I mean, this is one of the scenes I don't show my kids all of X-Men 97. I show them bits and pieces, like, my son likes Wolverine. But to that point, in Tolerance's Extinction, the whole like Nightcrawler and Wolverine battle. Wow. I mean, the shots, the way it was like, you guys filmed like that scene with animation. Like, that's insane to me. Like, the everything. I mean, the buildup, this, I mean, just the storytelling and that scene alone, that action scene was phenomenal. I mean, I would, and the buildup prior to this is we see a lot of Wolverine throughout the whole series. It's mostly Logan, though, and we finally see him get back into the action and Tolerance is Extinction, and he comes back like berserker mode. Like, it's, I mean, you really knew how to, you guys knew how to hit on the feels there, but I mean, how did that whole scene came to be? You picked those two characters to represent that scene and have that moment protecting Rogue. I mean, that was beautiful. How'd
Dude,
that come about?
that came from just, one, I've noticed that my storytelling style, it's weird to talk about my storytelling style at this point, but if you watch the show, I'm a big dominoes fan where I set up dominoes first half and then push them down. And episode 8 is probably the clearest example of that, where the first half of that episode is a lot of exposition and setting, table setting and bashing. Okay, oh, clear, we got this is the bad guy. Okay, cool, we got some emotional drama here. And then I knew we had the kind of segment. I knew I wanted to have different battle hubs and putting battle hubs that paid off emotional arcs for the season. So, Jubilee, Roberto over here. Scott, Jean, Cable, they're gonna have some family drama, bond action over here. And then Wolverine and Nightcrawler, it was just you want furry elf. Like, and you want them fighting Rogue. And it was an intentional. And I think people saw this by that point because I mean, obviously, everybody was like, oh, where's Wolverine? Where's Wolverine? Hulk smash is cool one or two times before you start expecting it. And so, when you're going to use Wolverine as your bruiser, you got to make sure you're using it at the best possible freaking moment. And Wolverine is never going to be more powerful than when he's defending the mansion. X-Men 2, it's one of the best scenes in X-Men 2. It's truly where that man's heart is. And it allowed us to tell this story where, like, you had one unlikely guy who found his way to the X-Men. And that scene is basically Nightcrawler's baptism into the X-Men. Because for the first time, he is fighting for the school, he's fighting for his sister, he's fighting from all of them against like impossible odds. And when I wrote that, see, I co-wrote it with Anthony Celletti, who, like, we beat out the outline and we got to that section. And I'm a big fan of action writing. So I was like, let me take this. I have a couple crazy ideas, which is usually when I say that, people get really nervous on the crew because they'd be like, oh shit, what are we gonna do? What is he gonna make us do? And Chase Conley was just easily our best director on the show. And he was a victim of his own success. He directed all the Even episodes. And I knew I could push him and his assistant director, David Maximo, and their core team, push them in ways. And so I remember I gave him that script. Especially the teleport beat. Chase just kind of looked at crazy. So I'm sorry for my language. He was just like, this is insane. I was like, dude, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be cool. It's going to be iconic. Like, and our goal in the last three episodes was basically to write an X-Men. Those last three episodes are a 90-minute X-Men. But also episode 8, whenever I watch it, it's maybe my favorite episode. I'm like, even episode 8 in itself is almost a movie so much. I feel the exhaustion of having written and produced that episode every single time I watch it. I'm like, oh, I'm glad that's over now. And it was also so awesome. I got to watch that actually with a group, bunch of fans at a bar in Hollywood. And just watching their faces as that first domino drops. And then watching it as they're just like, because I remember every episode 5, people were like, how are they gonna top it? How are they gonna top it? I'm like, episode 8 and episode 10, like episode 9 too, but episode 8 and 10 just have these moments where we got to go really big and do things that I feel like I was, as a fan, wanting to see the X-Men do. I'm also that Wolverine beat. I'm also a huge fan. If you watch Nightmare of the Wolf, I'm a huge sucker for aerial combat, Cyclops falling from the air. So, like,
Wolverine getting knocked out up into the sky. I ripped myself off of actually Vesemir doing a similar beat in Witcher. Was just something I just kind of wanted to see. And then David Maximo came in, huge fan. He's like, "Bo, you said we would be able to do a tornado claw sometime." He's like, "Can I do a tornado claw?" And Marvin Bibb did the boards for this. I was like, "Do a tornado claw." So if you look, there's a little beat where he does a little bit of a tornado claw.
All right.
So I mean, episode eight, I have a lot of fond memories. Episode eight is my like MCU live action. Let's see if you can beat that.
nice. It was iconic. I got to tell my kids. They were like, "What did we just see?" And I was like, "That's what it's like to teleport with Nightcrawler."
Yeah.
It's such a cool thing. Such a cool thing. And it happened like that, and you had to pay attention.
And what's great, and also like I need to give a huge shout out not only the chase in that episode, but also the Newton brothers. Like, and one, the music they were able to craft, I loved jamming with those guys, and they just slayed that episode. They slayed episode five. Episode five, we always knew we wanted to do the first kind of instrumental cinematic version of the X-Men theme when Genosha's being attacked. But I remember coming to them with the Porsche scene with Cyclops, which is also like a last minute addition. I was like, there's a Porsche in the back. And I'm a huge Bond fan. And so I was like, guys, we need a James Bond version of the X-Men theme. And so I showed him this car chase from No Time to Die, the Aston Martin chase. I was like, that's the vibe we need for this. And they killed it. They so killed that scene musically. But to your point too, not to be lost, it's like what was also important is each one of those scenes, the action's great, but like you pointed out, Rogue is the emotional anchor of the Nightcrawler action, Wolverine action. When Scott says, "Let's show, you know, what that why you don't screw with the Summers," the family unit is created. We've resolved that character arc, right? And then obviously with Jubilee Mordo, it's paying off their emotional arc and their romance for the entire season. A fun fact that I haven't talked about yet. Originally, Storm was going to come back at that episode when Cyclops, Jean, and then crash out into the ravine. There's going to be a moment where you heard just off screen, "Hard times, sister," and you turned around and it was Storm. And then her and Storm, like, Storm created a storm. Jean created a telekinetic bubble of lightning that was electrified, but it just tempo wise, you were escalating the action when at that point Bastion was supposed to be taking advantage. So we pushed it, but it's one of those beats that I kind of regret. I wish I had more time to figure out how to make it work. It was no one's fault other than a production schedule, but originally Storm was supposed to come back in the final moment there. But it also felt a little crappy to have Storm come back, do this big thing, and then get taken down anyways.
Storm's my girl. We don't want her taken down.
Also
Yeah.
robbed for
So.
Magneto's moment of like him really saving all the mutants.
Yeah. Well, so let's keep on the Nightcrawler thing real quick. Nightcrawler officially joined because he got a title card at the beginning. But Forge and Cable arguably were in the show just as much, if not more, than Nightcrawler, but they didn't get title cards. So would you say that they joined the X-Men or did they remain as allies?
Cable, no. Definitely not. I don't think his story is there yet. And then who was the other one? I just blanked.
Forge.
Forge, also, his story is not there yet. That is something I can tell you will be, you know, season two is weird because I'd written it and it was all going, but now, you know, I do know for a fact they're rewriting a lot of stuff for whatever reasons. But I can at least say in my original vision for season two and what we were producing when I departed, that was kind of the story, was where does Forge and Abel fit in the present?
I mean, it was all building up to that essentially too. Like, so yeah, that makes sense.
I wanted to know in a little bit of time before we do this trivia
Okay.
content, man. So Wolverine's choice to go for the kill for Magneto. Okay. So obviously that's kind of foregoing the entire plan to turn the power back on, but it's saving Charles. What does that choice say about his relationship to Charles and then Charles, Professor X vision or dream?
To me, Wolverine is the guy who will do the bad things so the dream can remain pristine. And so from Go in episode 9, you kind of hear him say very clearly, this day ends one way. This man just declared war. And like, we skirt around it for the adults in the room. Magneto did just kill thousands of people. Planes crash. When you read Fatal Attractions, they actually explicitly say it. Like, medical equipment crashed. Things crashed. Like, people are dead. And so I think Wolverine understands, one, there's not a world where Xavier will ever kill Magneto. The man love they both those men love each other too much. And so I think in that beat, what he is putting on the line, and what I think what Wolverine will always defend, is the man who gave him a second chance not to be an animal. And so it's twofold in that moment. It's, I will put my life on the man on this, like, for this man. I will do anything for him. I don't always agree with him, but I am, it's, I don't want to say he's literally Jack Nicholson and like a Few Good Men, but it is that same mentality. Like, I'm the man on the wall. You need me on that wall, and I'm on that wall so you can sleep your pretty little dreams. And I think that's what Wolverine kind of sees about himself. You look at it in all his story arcs. There is a very walking martyr quality to him, which is also very samurai, right? And so that's where that beat came from. But what I really hope people took from that beat is when he does it to Magneto, the thing, he repeats Magneto's own words to him. He says, like, the brave are always the first to die. He's actually saying Magneto is brave. So he's in this weird place where he's defending the man who he has loyalty to. But what he's actually saying in that moment, too, is, but I get it. What they did in Genosha, so I get it, but you gotta pay because you did the thing we cannot do. So it's a very complicated emotional moment that I like to watch people digest and debate. But the key that he uses, the same words that, Magneto said to them in the end of the first season of the original series, is kind of the clue there that that is very much the samurai warrior killing the other warrior and saying, I'm doing this out of duty, but I respect
Very cool. All right, a little chatter about cameos. Are there any cameos that you wanted in that were left out?
Woo! Give me just a couple seconds to think. God, we got a lot of them in. Dr. Octopus, I wanted Worf to turn into at one point, but we didn't have time. Who else? I feel like there's one that is slipping my mind right now. I know episode 10 was such a beast to write, and there were so many iterations of that draft, especially the around the world moment where you see the Sentinels. I think we got everybody, honestly. Spider-Man was the hardest because Sp
Really?
anything Spider-Man has to still be vetted
Yeah.
by
Oh, wow.
Sony. That was one that it requires a lot of emailing and checking and legal, including the Peter Parker moment with Mary Jane and Flash Thompson. I didn't tell Marvel that by doing that, I was actually resolving Hanger. I was like, I'm not going to tell this. I learned that from Larry Houston, who stuck cameos into the original show all the time and didn't tell people. That was my way of, like, if I tell them what I'm doing, they may nix this. I'm just going to be like, hey, Peter Parker of the original series. And then when it hit, people were like, wait a second, that means he found MJ. I'm like, yes.
All about
Trying to think of who else. There is one, it's slipping my mind. No, even Vulcan, we got in there. Vulcan originally had had a larger storyline in episode 6, but we trimmed it back because it started to take over the Lilandra Xavier subplot. But no, there was some Alpha Flight talk at some time that we couldn't really. You see Puck in Genosha, and that was the beauty of Genosha. Is like, you got to put a lot of people in there if you want.
Cameo Central.
And then there were certain people that we left out for purposeful reasons, because at the point in time I knew I was going to use them in season 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so we got time for one more question before we do this trivia game. So you have said that season 3 was going to be AOA, and us being all the same age, we're all huge AOA fans. Can you? It might not happen, and that's okay. But can you give us some little tidbits of what you were planning with AOA?
Yeah, the so the thing that shifted is Originally season two, we reworked it so it didn't do this, which is why, I mean, they may put another episode back on since they delayed it. But as at the time of my departure, it was nine. We had take I had written a 10th episode, which was the Rise of Onslaught, the Avengers, and the Fantastic Four had been seeded much like they had been through season one. Onslaught does something very terrible at Grady Creed's inauguration. And it was taking I took Onslaught Saga and I mixed it with Ultimate X-Men when Magneto attacks Washington, D.C. Only instead of it being George Bush in that, it was Grady Creed. And all the X-Men rally and they cannot defeat him. And then a particular X-Men who I will not mention goes back into the past, realizing that if they kill Magneto, and this is where I did a twist on Legion's Quest, that Onslaught could never be born. And what happens in Legion Quest, a version of that happens in the episode. And so season two ended with the reveal of Gambit back with us as a member of the Externals, breaking an old bishop out of a Shi'ar prison because the way we were going to crack it is that Age of Apocalypse. I loved how the Ewolds took us to space in season three. So our version was going to be yes, but the Age of Apocalypse is actually galactic. He took over the galaxy. And so it's, Gambit breaking him out with the star jammers, breaks Bishop out, they're running out, and then much like Rogue One, where Vader puts on the thing, they're in the hallway. Zoom, you see a red thing, and it's the Cyclops, it's bad Cyclops. And he basically starts murking all the star jammers, trying to prevent them from getting Bishop. Gambit's the only one that gets away, blast back on the star jammer ship, arrive back on Earth. Bishop is like, what? The X-Men? How are the X-Men still here? And then he turns and it's Magneto, Rogue holding Charles, their baby. And it's like, we're the X-Men. And then season three was going to be the entire season was going to be Earth, Shi'ar Empire, and very much like Star Wars, with Gambit as our lead, working to hijack the biggest heist of all, the Emkron Crystal, to set things back as Magneto realizes that he is supposed to be the villain. So there the resistance was, and this is what led to like massive fracture. The resistance to it was, which I don't feel it was my crew's fault, that after Quantumania and just the failure there, let's just be honest, I can finally be honest about that. They got really shy with multiverse, and I'm like, guys, it's not multiverse though. It's all timelines, X-Men fans. They know how to navigate alternate timelines like tying their shoes. Like it is the biggest 90s crossover. It is the number one most requested when I went to cons, talked to fans. The three most requested things are Kitty Pryde, Onslaught, and Age of Apocalypse. And so, and yeah, it was going to be ambitious because it's like basically rebooting an entire new show, all new production design, all new character designs. But like we could do it. And so when that got blown up, it was really the beginning of, I think, of the end of the creative relationship, on top of some of the stuff you guys have heard me talk about with I was witnessing, which led to this whole nightmare I'm in right now. But like it sucks that they got so gun shy about it because it could have been if you look at what I was kind of playing with Rogue and Magneto and Gambit. It was the it, Age of Apocalypse became the third act of that love triangle and where we find it.
Oh, that was
Man, I'm ready to watch. I'm
a
ready to watch that. Holy
Yeah, I
cow.
was ready to, but it is what it is.
All right, well, we try to end each episode with a trivia game. It's from this old school Marvel game that came out in 2001. So most of the trivia is 90s. So when you give an answer,
I
one of the
could be
questions is
terrible. I'm a
that.
horrible test person. I will tell you this.
Oh,
We'll see.
well, we'll let you go first, Bo. We'll let you go first, man. But so on each card, there's five questions and they're rated in difficulty. So if you pick a one, you get 1 point if it's correct. If you pick a five and you answer that question correct, you get 5 points. The first
Ooh.
person to 15 points wins. Now,
Okay.
Bo, you're new to this, but since this game came out in 2001, one of the questions that's a five is who was Captain America's sidekick in the 40s? Well, today we all know it was Bucky because of the Winter Soldier, but when this game came out, nobody knew that. So try and change your mindset to like 2008.
Oh, okay. There's an added layer to this. Okay, gotcha. Let's go.
Yeah. All right. We're also keeping our own scores. So, Bo, 1 to 5, what would you like?
Let's start with a good three.
What is Bullseye's power?
Oh, he can hit any target.
Yes. Bo got 3 points. All
Oh.
right. All right, Andy.
I'm going to go with a two. I am not confident.
Which member of Alpha Flight is a dwarf?
Puck.
That's a
Puck.
two?
All right, Darren.
Oh,
All right, I'll go three.
What is Deadpool's real name?
Wilson.
Oh, these are good, guys. You guys are doing
Oh,
awesome. All right, Bo.
we're all winning.
All right, Mr. DeMeo, what would you like?
I'll try a five just to embarrass myself.
Oh, this isn't right. This is the writer of X-Men 97. The question is, what is Bolivar Trask's occupation?
He's the inventor of the Sentinels, the scientist.
Yes.
Come on, that's not a
My gosh.
Okay.
Who shuffled these? All right, Andy.
I'll do a four.
Who was the second Hobgoblin?
Oh man, Spider-Man is my guy. It's not Roderick Kingsley, right? And
Oh.
Ned Leeds.
Jason McIndale.
My head was like my I went like Norman Reedus. No, that's the wrong. Oh, that was a hard one, dude.
I
Right, I
appreciate you
got
saying that.
right, Darren.
I got lucky with a three. I'm gonna shoot the moon. Let's go for a five.
Oh, you got this one. Besides Black Bolt and Medusa, name three other Inhumans.
I probably don't. Oh man. I'm having a brain freeze right now. Lockjaw.
Bo DeMeo is watching you,
I
Darren.
know. I
Don't
know.
panic.
The rest of the cast on the ABC show.
Crystal, Karnak, Triton, Gorgon, and Lockjaw.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
close. You had two. You stopped at Karnak. I was like, no, it's completed. It.
No, I
Lockjaw.
know, I know, I know. It happens a lot.
All right, Bo.
I'll try four. Watch fours be actually the hard one because they're punishing the people who are like, I'm not
Right.
gonna try.
No, I feel like Bo came over, picked these cards especially for him. Listen to this. Where is the Dark Beast from?
Age of Apocalypse.
Yes. Bo, we play this game every time, and the questions are never this like this. They're always crazy hard. Like, who was the second Hobgoblin?
That is a question. Because even I was like, okay.
I'll try a four.
What is Peter Parker's father's name?
Richard.
Richard. All right.
Yeah.
All right,
That's
Darren, can you
a
come
slick,
back?
that's an easy one to
Yeah,
get tricked.
I'm gonna go one.
Which hero is described as incredible?
The man. Hulk?
Yes.
All of our faces were not kind
I
on
sold it. It's not Morph?
that one. Bo, how many points do you have?
I've got 12.
Okay, so you could win it here.
Go for a five.
I'll do a five.
What year was Daredevil introduced?
I'm gonna say 1976.
Before.
Oh, it's close.
Oh, you could have had it with a three. All right, Andy.
I need a five, so.
Okay. When they're looking for a decade, when was the Hellfire Club founded?
Oh, wow.
Founded like in the comics or like in the publishing?
Yeah.
Comment.
Man, I don't know. The ninth, the I don't know, the 1850s.
The 1600s. I guess that's not a decade, is it? I didn't. That didn't really help you.
Last century. Last
I was
century.
like,
Last
he should get
century.
another one because that made it sound like the comic books, honestly. It was like the 50s, but yeah.
Sorry about that.
I'm
Darren.
back. I'm moving back up to a three. Here we go.
All right. Who is Sean Cassidy?
Oh, Banshee.
All right, Banshee.
Nice.
He's
All
also
right.
dead.
Yeah, Bo killed him. Thanks, Bo. Appreciate that,
I
man.
feel really bad. Everyone's like Gambit, Gambit. I'm like, what about Banshee and Mirror?
Poor guy.
And Leech.
Like
Or
a
Leech.
redheaded stepchild.
Callisto.
I'll do a three. I'm just gonna aim for a perfect 15.
All right. Who was Peter Parker's first love?
First love. See, I would actually argue that this is debatable because Gwen Stacy should be the answer, but then Betty Brant is all he fell in love with her too. I'm gonna go with Gwen Stacy.
It's science.
You're correct. You're correct.
Yes! That's a good answer too. Science is a good answer. So
congratulations,
that's 15. Wow, that's actually, some of those are
congratulations.
actually really hard. The Decade of the Hellfire Club.
That was tough.
You would have to almost have read 1402 to really, or was it 1402? Yeah, 1402, 1602. What's
1602. Yeah.
yeah, 1502. I bet
16.
that's when they talk about it.
And that was, oh man, that was when I was in college. That was in 2001, like
Yeah.
that 2000 when that came out. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Ooh, that Ned Leeds. Because I would have said Ned Leeds too, but how
I
poor.
think, Bo, I think you enjoyed that. I think you're going to want to come back and do the show again because you
No,
had so much
absolutely.
fun with
I'll come back
trivia.
and do it again. I have work tonight to
Certainly.
do it. I have a new project to do. I can't talk about it. You'll hear about it in January. I got
Okay.
to do with that today. But no, let's do this again. And we can do, I'll come over there. We can do it live in person.
Well,
Yeah.
I'm in Ohio. Are you coming to Ohio?
Oh, I thought you said you were in LA.
No, when you had said I could get you tickets maybe to the premiere, so I was gonna fly out
Well,
and
I didn't get to go to the premiere, dude. So you're in good company.
I know. I know. I'm sorry.
Let's do this again, guys. Absolutely.
So, Bo, was Mystique in season one?
Originally, that was my plan, but then, okay, I'm just going to tell you guys this. Originally, Mystique was supposed to be Val Cooper.
Oh, nice.
I knew it. After seeing the cut of episode 8, the sincerity of Val Cooper's turn, it
Yeah.
robbed from it. It robbed from it. And so in season 2, I made the decision that Mystique would be someone else. Good question.
Bo,
See, the
thank you
question I
so
thought
much.
you were going to ask me is when did Jean Grey get switched out?
Oh.
It was on here. It was on here.
Yes. I'm going to talk about it on my channel, but I will tell you guys if we turn off when it is. This is off
Yeah.
record.